Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. It's good to have you here. It's good to have the mayor of Seattle here. Jenny Durkin's in the studio with me. Welcome, Mayor.
Hey, Bill. It's great to be back.
You and I both had mellow 4th of Julys. We didn't try to do too much.
And it was on a Wednesday. It was hard to do too much.
Middle of the week. Can we talk money to begin with, Mayor?
Let's talk money.
We always end up talking money, as should be. I saw Seattle Business Magazine broke down the city's budget, as you do for a living, and they put it this way. They had four conclusions. Number one, this is the last year Seattle can continue its pattern of slight deficit spending because the fund balance is exhausted. Number two, economic growth is slowing, which will hold down revenue growth as expenses climb. Number three, Seattle's economy and the city budget have become dependent on the cyclical construction industry, and when that time bomb goes off, it will be painful. And number four, the city council needs to discover the virtues of fiscal discipline in time for the budget development process. Is that accurate to you?
We have been planning for reducing our budget since I walked in the door.
Yes.
I've asked every one of my department heads to give me a budget that was lower, and we're even paring that back because if we look at the projections going forward, we know we have to live within our means. We know there will be things that come up we didn't plan for, and there's programs that end up costing more than you thought they would because you start to expand them because they work. So we have to be looking out at a 3- and 5-year scenario, knowing that we always go through cycles in Seattle, knowing that we've got to be able to live within our means. So, yes, it's going to be the year of fiscal discipline.
What is the biggest budget cut coming?
I wouldn't say the biggest budget cut, but I would say you will see across all departments reductions. And sometimes those reductions are going to be in holistic terms, meaning the budget itself has to be less. Sometimes it'll be program by program. So I think what we really have to do is start with what do we have to do to keep this city running? Basic city services, police, fire, fill the potholes. So we know what we have to do. Then we go, what do we need to do next? And so we build the budget instead of trying to just cut. We build it from a basis to say, what do we want to be doing and have to be doing?
Do you know of one budget cut that is on the way that you'll tell us about now?
I think you'll see budget cuts across all departments. There are some that because they're smaller or because that they're just beginning as programs like our Office of Labor Standards, they won't be able to take as much of a cut because they have programs that they're required to actually build.
Yeah.
But you'll see cuts in probably every department. We're going to do everything we can first to protect basic city services and public safety.
Budget cuts tend to fall on the poor. Why not raise property, sales, business and occupation, utility, taxes, business license fees?
You know, we are going to do everything we can to protect those social service programs because we as a city know that we've had this huge disparity between what some people make and what others do, and poverty has grown. So we want to make sure we protect those social programs. But the tax revenues we have today, if you talk to anyone in parts of the city, people are starting to feel that they are not tapped out, but they need to know what they're getting for their money. And I hear that everywhere I go. If they know that it's something that's worthy and that it's going to show up as something good in Seattle, they're willing to pay for it. But they want us to prove that they're using their money wisely.
Well, we often in the media and people who and businesses who pay taxes often focus on what government isn't getting right or is spending too much money on. But what's a case you want to make for, hey, this is something Seattle's doing that actually helps people that you don't realize how effective and cost efficient this is? Let's pick one.
One I'd pick is our Seattle Families and Education Levy. You know, we since early 90s have had that supplement for our schools, and it has put the Seattle Public Schools in a better place and every kid. We're going to be renewing that levy and renewing the preschool levy. So both of them expire this year. We're going to be combining them.
Both on the November ballot?
Both on the November ballot as one levy.
So yes.
To continue that levy, it's the kind of investment that I hear everyone in Seattle is willing to make in our kids and their future. So we'll increase almost double the number of preschool slots. We're going to have new programs to close the opportunity gap and increase health care in the schools. And we're going to make sure every Seattle Public School kid gets 2 years free college.
The owner of a median home would pay an extra $112 per year, I've seen it, for this levy. City Councilor Shama Sawant called it a tax on regular working people as opposed to the business head tax that the city passed and then repealed. How do you respond to that?
Well, the property taxes that it comes from, we have to remember that businesses pay those property taxes. And in fact, a significant portion of property taxes are paid by businesses in Seattle. If you take single family homeowners and businesses, they pay the lion's share of property taxes in Seattle. So they're already paying for that. And again, it is probably one of the things we can do to increase the opportunity most for people in this city. We have over 700,000 jobs coming to the Puget Sound Basin in the next 5 to 7 years. Most of them require some post-high school training certificate or degree, and only 30% of our kids are getting it. So if we want our kids to get those jobs of the future so that they can support themselves, have good family wage jobs, this is an investment that for City of Seattle will pay off 10 times and more.
Well, as it relates to the head tax, Councilor Lorena Gonzalez said one reason she voted to repeal the head tax is she thought voters would see a repeal on their November ballot and they would turn out to vote for that and vote against the education levy. Do you see scrapping the head tax as a worthwhile trade-off to help save the education levy?
I think Seattle voters are pretty smart. So I think even if the head tax was going to be on the ballot, while it would have been difficult to do it, everywhere you go, people understand the value of education. And they see in this city that if you don't want to be spending the dollars 5, 10, 15, 20 years to support people through social programs, the best thing you can do is give them opportunity. And that's education, early learning, K through 12, and college. And if we do that, we will be, it's one of the best things we can do for the city.
Well, one final question, I think, about the head tax. Again, there's no longer this tax that was going to raise $47 million a year, and that was going to pay for services for homeless people and for affordable housing. And a listener has a question along those lines.
My name is Birgit Ages. My question is, what are you going to do about the homeless crisis and the high cost of living in Seattle? Rent should be commensurate with income, and income is way out of whack. The rents are way out of whack, especially if you're not working at Amazon and Microsoft.
What do you say to that listener?
We absolutely have to do better to raise wages to begin with. So that is a really important part of that question, because we are seeing today that huge disparity. That's when, again, going back to the families and education levy, the more people we get that certificate and degree and get family income wages, the more apprenticeship programs we have with labor, we'll be able to raise those wages. The second thing we have to do is we have to have regional solutions to homelessness that have to involve the state, the county, and the city. Today, we have a very fragmented approach, and I've been talking to mayors around the region as well as the county executive, working through one table, the governor. We have to do something, for example, about behavioral health. We all know that mental health and opioid issues on the streets are a huge part of the problem, but the city of Seattle doesn't have the dollars. Those dollars go through the city and the county. We've got to have a holistic solution so that we address homelessness for what it is and provide people with not just housing, but the supports they need to get back on their feet.
This is Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, and this KUOW listener sees homelessness and kind of ranks it alongside other issues.
Hello, my name is Alex, and I was just wondering how Seattle can justify the ban on reusable plastics in the city while they continue to let people have full-on encampments pretty much anywhere they please, allowing those people just to use drugs wherever they want to downtown. I just don't understand how the resources are, or why the resources are being put into such silly things as that when there's such a crisis going on downtown with the homelessness and drug problem. Thank you.
What do you say, Mayor?
I don't think we have to play off good things against each other. I think we can do things that are good for the environment and try to address people experiencing homelessness.
Can we afford to do both? We started out talking about money.
We can't afford not to. We have to be able to help people move off the streets, out of RVs, and into safe places to live. It's one reason why we are increasing in the next 60 to 90 days, almost 25% the number of shelter spots available so people have a safe place to go. Right now, our navigation team goes out, they connect with people living in tents and RVs and doorways, but they don't have places to move them. We need to have places to move them. And if we do that, then we can start to see a change in the city, fewer tents, less garbage. And then we need to get treatment for the people who are experiencing addiction problems. The city can't do that alone. That's a county and state function. I've been talking to city and county leaders, county and state leaders about that. We have to do something more on that front.
Okay, so that listener didn't like the plastics, the plastic utensil, non-reusable straw ban. I'm talking with Mayor Jenny Durkin. Here's another listener who sees a Seattle institution as being silly or worse.
Hi, Bill. This is Janet Leonard, Seattle resident. I really appreciate your show, The Record. I have a question for the mayor, and that is I appreciate her climate initiative. And in that vein, I think the Blue Angels have outlived their currency, let's say. I would appreciate it if she could address the question of who says okay that the Blue Angels visit Seattle every year and why. My concerns are, number one, the carbon footprint they contribute to, number two, the traffic problems they increase here, number three, the cost to the citizens for the Parks Department, for the security, et cetera, and number four, the noise pollution. So it seems like it's an event that's outlived its time. Thank you.
Her first question, Mayor, was, who says it's okay? Is that you?
You know, we work together with Seafair and plan these events years in the future. And I've heard a lot of criticisms about the Blue Angel. In fact, in the 80s and 90s here, we had so many immigrants and refugees in South Seattle who had experienced in war zones that it was troublesome. I will admit a great fondness myself to the Blue Angels. I think that they are a master in flight, in engineering, and humankind. I can see how other people don't like them. The carbon footprint is an issue, but I still, I hate to admit it, but I come down on the side of the Blue Angels.
Carbon, traffic, security money, noise, all worth it.
I think that if you take the Seafair as a whole, it's a really positive thing for this community. And you look at all of those events together, they all cause different parts of traffic. There's parts of the city get congested, and each one of them contribute. But if you take it as a whole, I think it really is not only historically kind of what Seattle's been about, but it brings people together in a whole lot of ways, which I think is fantastic.
Mayor Durkin, speaking of traffic congestion, is the city going to charge people to drive downtown?
We are looking at that. It is years away to be able to implement it. You'd need the technology. We have to do lots of outreach. We have to make sure that it's equitable so people that are poor aren't shouldering the burden of it. But I think there's a number of things we can do to improve traffic in the downtown core. The first thing we've got to do, the most important thing we have to do, is get people out of single occupancy vehicles. So we've got to get people onto transit, into carpools, and sometimes not coming into town at all. So that's got to be the first focus.
For Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin, we have a listener call about another kind of transportation besides the car.
Dave Storm, Seattle. Just briefly, I'm a newcomer, and I'm just hopeful that the First Avenue trolley car is approved, that Pioneer Square becomes a gem rather than a sort of crime-ridden spot during the evening. I believe they would all work together, that having the streetcar would improve the pedestrian aspect of the area, and I feel that it's way below its potential.
This is the unbuilt First Avenue streetcar line between Pioneer Square and Westlake. It's over budget. You stopped the project in March and ordered an outside review. The deadline for that review is June. Mayor, where's the review?
So there's two problems with the streetcar project that we posit is. First is we didn't know how much it was going to cost to build it. The estimates were millions and millions of dollars apart. Second, we didn't know how much it was going to cost to operate it. They, too, were million-dollar spreads. So we believe that the public has a right to know before they embark on such a big project, how much will it cost to build? How much will it cost to operate? We had a preliminary review. KPMG came and briefed. There were some questions they still hadn't answered that they need to go back and look at. For example, one of the things that we know is the new streetcars, as designed, are longer than the current ones we have and heavier. They won't fit in the maintenance barns, for example, and we're not sure they can fit on the gauge of rail that's there. So we need, before we start a project like that, to know how much is it going to cost to build, how much is it going to cost to operate, and how many people will it really move? Because the goal of transit has got to be to move as many people through Seattle as we can. You know, I also want to go back to when we're talking about the time of maximum constraint, making the city friendlier for bicycles and pedestrians is going to be critical too. That's another key way we get people out of their cars.
So are you saying it could be that Seattle will not build the line to connect the two existing streetcar lines?
That
still might not happen?
That still might not happen. We're looking at the options. And there may be other options that are available to connect those two things that won't be a continuous route. We're in the process now of looking at both the technical data, the ridership estimates, and also what will it do for, there's a lot of businesses up and down First Avenue because we did utilities work that was necessary. Some of those pipes were wooden. But tearing up those streets takes a heavy toll on those businesses as well. So we're looking at all those factors. I will say Pioneer Square has come a long ways. I worked in Pioneer Square in the 70s and worked in a factory down there filling boxes and cutting threads off coats. And it was a much grittier place then than it is now. Activating that park has made a huge difference. Having Weyerhaeuser come to Pioneer Square has been a terrific thing. So I think once we get this construction done with some of the businesses that are there and the community that's growing, Pioneer Square is really a great place to be.
Mayor, that's our time.
I hate that. We ran out of time.
What's harder, balancing budgets or cutting threads off coats?
I would say cutting threads off budgets.
Yeah, that's what it's coming to. Seattle's Mayor Jenny Durkin, that's the 15 minutes we get with you, and it flew by. Let's do it again soon.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mayor. Seattle's Mayor Jenny Durkin on the record on KUOW. You're going to meet a new U.S. citizen in just a moment. Stay tuned. It's the record on KUOW, and we live tweet this show at KUOW, so come on social media and join us. I'm Bill Radke. Yesterday, in the shadow of the Space Needle on the 4th of July, nearly 500 people became citizens of the United States.
I hereby declare on oath that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince or potentate, state or sovereignty, of whom or which I have heretofore been a subject or citizen.
Okay, we have heretofore abjured those potentates, and one of the voices you heard repeating those words was Otman Ramouni, who immigrated to the U.S. from Morocco 18 years ago. Otman, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having me.
You first came here as a student. What drew you to the United States?
Well, back as a teenager when I was in high school, I always had a dream of going to the U.S. and really having an impact in the technology world. And the best companies in the world that were really having an impact were in the U.S. It was the Microsoft, the Apples of the world, and I just wanted to be part of it. So my dream was to pursue a degree in computer science and go work for one of those companies, which 3 years later, at the age of 22, I had a job at Microsoft.
And I know logistically it's a lot easier to be a citizen than working here as a non-citizen, but beyond that, why did you want to become a citizen? Did it have to do with American identity, or was it really for you just about those important logistics?
No, it's a complex question. I think that as an immigrant, there is always an aspect of wanting to belong anywhere you go. And I think we're very adaptable in that way. But I think practically, there are just a lot of things that make it much easier. I mean, hey, you can vote, but travel is a big one for me. I've always had a passion for travel. I've had the chance to go to over 25 countries. But every time you go through a border, whether it's entering, exiting the U.S., or trying to visit another country, logistically it's very complicated, especially if you happen to be from a country that is considered in the developing world, where every time you're trying to visit France or Colombia or Vietnam, there is just logistically a lot more paperwork, a lot more processes you have to go through, versus being a U.S. citizen, you can just book a flight and just go there. You might either not have to have a visa, or you can get one upon entry.
So beyond those travel restrictions, how does being a now United States citizen, how does that change your life on the inside, if at all?
You know, it's been, have you ever waited for anything for 18 years? I mean, it's hard to describe what it is. I think there is always relief, or there is always like, okay, finally. I think that's kind of what it feels like. I think it's a process that you absolutely look forward to. And I think that's a long time ago. I knew that I wanted to have my life here, and I've pursue opportunities here, but it's always been one of those things where at any given time, any new policy from the government can ultimately completely change the course of your life, where at any given time, you might be denied entry into the country. And so that completely changes your view on the world. But ultimately, I'm an optimist. So I always believe that anywhere I go, I can make it. And so seems like I'm meant to be here. And so I'm very excited to be a U.S. citizen now.
Well, yes, we certainly are aware of government immigration policy. What do you say, Atman, to some Americans who say we should put a pause on immigration?
For me, something like that statement is almost like comical in a way, because the perception of the U.S. all over the world is this land of opportunity, this land of immigrants, and denying that, it's almost like this is the brand of this country. This is what it was based on. And putting that there just doesn't make any sense. It's almost like, I don't know, I'm a technology guy, so thinking that, you know, Apple says, you know, we're no longer about technology. It's like, well, that just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't align from a branding perspective. I think that the strength of this country is these waves of immigrants that come in and ultimately change the world. You look at a lot of the companies that were started in the technology field, and I think half or like some, I don't know the exact statistic on top of my head, but a significant number of them were started by people that weren't born here. And so I think there is a lot of strength in terms of bringing in all this great talent to ultimately create the next wave of innovation and create, drive our country and ultimately humanity forward.
Well, Atman, please put modesty aside and make yourself an example. What, you are a new citizen. What do you add to the United States of America?
I've looked at that a while back, and I've decided that all I can do with my life is be a positive change in this world. And then for me, what makes me different is my passion for technology, wellness, and fitness. So I've decided a few years ago to focus my time on becoming an entrepreneur. And my passion is around helping people live a healthier and happier life. And so that's why I wake up every morning focusing on. And hopefully we'll be talking again a few months, a few years from now, telling you all about that impact that I was able to have in this country and hopefully the world.
Well, yeah, what's one thing you're doing to bring all those technological benefits about? What's your work?
Yeah, so I work on many different things, but currently working on a new technology startup that is actually based in the Bay Area. My co-founder and I are working on a company that allows you to go exercise anywhere you want. And the company is called Social Fitness. And our aim is to make exercising fun and ultimately making it easy for people to go exercise anywhere they want directly from their mobile device at any local fitness location around town. Think about it as any of these new apps where you can just put out your phone, get one membership, and go exercise anywhere you want. There's a lot more to it, but this is one of the core value proposition we want to bring. And so if we make it easy for people to go exercise, they can do so and have a happier and healthier life.
Okay, exercise, easy, social, mobile, fun. Sounds pretty good. Welcome to the United States, Atman.
Thank you, sir.
He's been in the United States for 18 years, but Atman Rahmani is now a citizen of the United States. I came from Morocco 18 years ago, around the year 2000. You're listening to The Record. We're going to be right back. You're listening to The Record on KUOW. On Monday, while many of us were going about our daily work, scientists from NASA and NOAA undertook the first ever mission to hunt down a meteorite in the ocean. The ship explored just 16 miles off the coast of Washington in the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary. Their target, a space rock that fell on March 7th, one about the size of a golf cart and weighing over 2 metric tons. And joining us to talk about what the search found is Jenny Waddell, research coordinator at the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary. She was on that exploration ship. Jenny, welcome.
Thank you.
The first mission to hunt down a meteorite in the ocean. Why now?
Well, we were really lucky that the stars aligned to actually mount a search using a really sophisticated ship with the capabilities that we would really need to do a search of this type.
Why? Why do you want to find a meteorite off the coast or anywhere?
Well, this was a really unusual event. According to my NASA colleagues, this is the largest meteorite fall in the U.S. since record keeping began. He uses NOAA's NEXRAD radar to search for meteorites, and this one had a really unusual signature to it. Not only was it the largest fall that we've documented, it also has a really interesting signature in the radar returns that make us think that it's an unusual composition of meteorite.
And why do we want to have it?
Well, this is something that NASA can really use to get at the history of the solar system. The meteorites tend to be very, very old material, some dating back further than the Earth's beginning. So it's of great interest to the scientific community that studies the history of the solar system.
Okay, how do you find a meteorite in the ocean?
That is a good question, and we didn't really know how to do it. So we came up with a few creative solutions on how we might search for a meteorite. Some involved plates of magnets that we waved above the seafloor to attract anything with a metallic signature. Others used the ship's capabilities, including a suction sampler, so sort of a vacuum that you can use to suck up a lot of the Earth's floor on the seafloor. We also were able to use some scoops that we had crafted from material, a variety of materials, to try and pull up some of the seafloor and sift out the silt.
Okay, sucking, scooping, and magnet pulling. That sounds cool. How big are these meteorite fragments we're talking about?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and we weren't quite sure. The largest one that Mark saw on radar, and Dr. Mark Fries of NASA, the largest one that he saw on radar was about 4.5 kilograms, or maybe 10 pounds, and about 5 inches in diameter. However, the radars aren't so good at picking up the larger fragments, so we suspected that there could be even larger fragments on the seafloor.
And what else does it look like besides 5 inches across?
Yeah, so it's a really dense material. It looks a lot like rock, a lot like granite or a really dense rock. But then most of it is also covered by what's called a fusion crust. As the meteor is falling through the atmosphere, it encounters so much friction that it actually sort of melts the exterior of the rock and gives you a really dark black crust on it. And so the trick is to find a meteorite as well as the fusion crust. We have a lot of fusion crust that we found, but we do think there may be small meteorites in there as well. We won't know until Mark takes everything back to the lab and really analyzes it.
Could the meteorite be carrying a scary alien substance against which humans have no immunity?
I'm told there is no chance of that.
Excellent.
Yes, I
can't tell you
too.
How pleased I am to hear that answer.
I was pleased too.
Okay, so this is not the first expedition you've been on. What else are you looking for in the marine sanctuary?
Oh, we do a lot of work in the marine sanctuary with both the oceanographic conditions as well as the biota that lives here, all of the interesting creatures. Last year, we were able to do a 16-day research cruise on this same vessel to look at deep sea corals and sponges at the bottom of the submarine canyons. We've got three major submarine canyons that bisect Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary, and so we're very interested to know what communities are there.
Okay, well, you have my email address should you want to invite me to the submarine canyons. I'd probably say yes. So thanks
okay,
for this
great.
Conversation. Jenny Waddell, research coordinator at the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary, part of the team hunting for meteorites there, and she told us what they think they found, they hope they found. They send it to the Smithsonian now. Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The Record. We're going to come right back. The Procrastinator's Guide to a Northwest Summer. The Record on KUOW Seattle. Well, the fireworks have cooled off enough to pick them up, so don't just leave them there. Seattle summer has officially begun, all 8 weeks of it. Now, if you're new to this area, you might not have known that you ought to book your campsite months in advance, get the trail passes and stuff that you didn't do. Never fear, there are still great summer options for procrastinators. We are live tweeting this show, so let us know your idea for the Procrastinator's Guide to a Seattle Area Summer. What's an awesome thing to do around here? We're on Twitter at KUOW. You can call us 206-543-5869. That's 543-5869. Let's start with some ideas here. My first guest is Nick Jaran, producer and host of the Northwest Nerd podcast. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me. This is fun.
It's already fun?
It's already fun.
Wow.
I haven't been to the studio before.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'd love to have you here. What are some outdoorsy nerds? It's Northwest Nerd Podcast. So what are some outdoorsy nerd favorites?
Well, I'm going to already disappoint you because I didn't choose anything outdoorsy. Because
okay.
As a true Northwest nerd, I picked things where you can go inside to escape the heat of the summer.
That's kind of a thing. Like, do you force yourself outside, or can you just enjoy yourself inside and feel okay about it?
I run into this fairly often. I don't feel much pressure to force myself into a hike. There's already so many people doing that. I'm your other friend who, like, hey, you want to go inside to a dark room and play some pinball for a couple hours? Like, let's do that.
Pinball, by the way, there's a lot of bells and flippers in this town, right?
Yes.
I mean, I don't travel that much lately, but pinball-wise, we're solid.
We're secretly a hotbed of pinball talent and pinball machines. Seattle and Portland are number one and number two in number of pinball machines for American cities. And we are also home to the number one and number three world champions of pinball.
Huh.
And there's so many places you can go down to Belltown. You can go to Shorty's. Which is kind of it's the original. There's
the
also
Mecca.
Jupiter,
yeah.
Just a couple blocks away, which I'm a huge, huge fan of. So much pinball. There's also Attaball up in Fremont. There's another Castle locations throughout the Sound, Marysville, Bremerton. They're all over the place. We secretly really love pinball and being inside around here.
We really do. Yeah. We're lousy with the pinballs. And I understand there are pin crawls. You just move progressive pinball.
My podcast partner loves pinball so much that he'll go on to it's called the Skillshot app. It's a group that has put together a pinball map of all of the places that you can find pinball, even if that's not the main attraction there, like a Full Tilt ice cream, for example. You might go in and get a funky flavor of ice cream, but then also run into four kind of rare and kind of new pinball machines as well.
On Rainier, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're all over the place, actually. They have a couple different locations.
Okay.
But we'll go down to Belltown or around the Queen Anne area and crawl all the way around there to like four or five different places sometimes. He loves putting together these pin crawls. And other things that you want to do
inside. Yeah, other things.
Yeah. You could head up north from Seattle up to Everett and go to the Funko headquarters, which is really cool. Funko, I'm sure people have probably seen these, even if they haven't caught the bug yet and started collecting them. But they're the oversized head figurines with the perfectly circular little eyes on there.
Yeah.
They come in absolutely every fandom. You can get your Darth Maul. You can get your Chewbacca. But you can also get your Frodo from Lord of the Rings or anything like that. Like, if there's a TV show that you love, Firefly, for example, which isn't even on anymore, but people love it. You can get Funko Pops of those. And at the headquarters, it's kind of like a Willy Wonka, but for Funko Pop figurines. You can go in there. They have a Bat Cave, an ice cave from Star Wars set that you can go and check out as well. It's really cool. You can't miss the building from the outside. It's got these gigantic Funko Pop statues along the walls outside. It's amazing.
Okay, pinball, Funko, any other indoor suggestions, since that's your jam
any
today.
Other indoor suggestions? Let me, I have one, actually. And this one requires a little bit more planning than the other two, because those two are kind of freeform. You can do them whenever. But there's a great playtesting group for indie tabletop and board games called Playtest Northwest. You can find all of their events on meetup.com to search for Playtest NW. And they do these throughout Seattle and in Bellingham, around Seattle, the Seattle greater area as well. But these are people who are developing board games, taking part in just the explosion of popularity that board games have had lately. And they're creating new ones. You got different types of card games. I've seen one where you can competitively grow a dwarf, like from Lord of the Rings. You competitively grow his beard. And that's the game. Whoever has the longest beard at the end wins. I can't remember.
Competitive beard growing.
Exactly, yeah. And you can play all kinds of funky, independent games like that and then give worthwhile feedback to these people as well so that they can improve these games. It's really cool.
I always struggle with competitive beard growing in my own life. This could be the second chance.
Personally.
Is that right? Yeah. This is Nick Jaran from the Northwest Nerd Podcast. And also here, because there's a lot of different ways to attack the Northwest in summertime, to go at it. We have from the Evergrey, this is the online publication and e-newsletter, the Evergrey. We have their storytelling producer, Anna Sophia Knauf, with us. Anna Sophia, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into, and you do have some outdoor recommendations, right?
I do, surprisingly.
You do? Okay, that's good. That's good. How do you feel on that question of pressure to get outdoors?
I think it's totally real. I feel like summer is Seattle's best and worst kept secret. In the rest of the year, it's kind of gray, but it's lovely. But in the summertime, I feel like everyone knows there's a ton of stuff to do.
Yeah. Okay, so before we get to outdoor, what's an indoor thing we could look forward to?
Oh, indoor thing. Oh, no.
Yeah.
My personal favorite indoor activity is drinking iced tea in my backyard.
Yeah.
So
do you call that indoors or outdoors if you're just in your backyard?
Basically, it's like a cheat. It's like outdoors, yeah. but kind of cheating.
It's like car camping.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Hey, there's no judge.
I love car camping. I went to Salmon Le Sac this last weekend.
Perfect.
Great. So outdoor recommendations now. Something called caboozing. I'm not familiar.
Caboozing. I'm glad I got to introduce you to this. So in college, as a UW student, I would go to the Water Activity Center on the waterfront behind the Husky Stadium and rent out a canoe with my friends. And we would take some six packs of beer and whatever else we're feeling that day.
Is that legal?
Get out in the water. That's a great question.
Thank you.
I'm not seeking the answer to that.
Fair enough.
I would rather not know.
Okay. So caboozing. What do you think caboozing, Nick?
I think skirt the law, have some fun. It's summertime. Capture that youthful exuberance, you know?
If outdoor fun is so fun, why do people add alcohol to it? I feel like if there's a time for me, a moment to not drink, it would be when I'm in a boat or camping. Like, do you drink when you ski? Is it really necessary?
You probably just invented something new right there.
I mean, do you want the real answer? Or do you want the answer for the kids? Because we're on broadcast right now.
You can be real with me.
I mean, just put a little buzz on it and makes a little bit more fun. Pretty much anything.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
But don't drink too much that you fall out of your boat, because
definitely
that's not
that.
Fun.
Yes, agreed.
And wear a life jacket always.
Yes. Any other outdoorsy recommendations?
Definitely. I'm a big fan of going to the Beacon Hill Food Forest. I live about a block and a half from it. It's basically a big park right underneath Jefferson Park where lots of edible food, including blueberries, apples, pears, tomatoes, zucchini, all kinds of stuff is grown. And it's free to the public. It's a really fun place.
It's free to the public because you're stealing it?
No,
oh,
not
good.
Stealing it. I know, I've already talked about illegal stuff already, but...
Good.
Possibly illegal.
Uh-huh.
But I believe it's free to the public to use. Right above its pea patches, not free to the public.
Yep.
But you can go in, nom on some berries or take some things to go, and then you can wander up to Jefferson Park and head to the playground or the skate park up there.
Okay, Beacon Hill Food Forest. Anything outside the city?
Outside the city? My favorite, it's not really hidden, but up on the peninsula near the Ho Rainforest, you can head out to Bogachiel Campground. It's also the Bogachiel Rainforest. It's right along a really beautiful river that's like pleasantly warm in the summer.
Hmm.
Really fun to go jump in and swim around. And it's also really close to the fun beaches out there. It's a great spot.
Bogachiel,
Bogachiel
State Park on the peninsula.
So, yeah.
Okay, and then finally, any overall summer advice to newcomers? We have a lot of newcomers here. What do you want to say about summer?
I think summer is a great time to explore Seattle because people are super stoked for life because it's sunny. And even if they're sweaty, which I'm not a fan of, they're really excited to be out there. So it's a great time to explore the city. We have all kinds of cool events happening. Right in the middle of the city, we have a cool dance series called Dancing Till Dusk that has free dance lessons. There's swing dance, tango, and more. There's also outdoor movies, which is just a fun way to get involved with the community. If you're feeling lonely, even if you're going by yourself, it's like a nice way to not feel alone.
Yeah.
So catch a movie under the stars. I think there's Black Panther and Jurassic Park coming up, just to name a couple.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Black Panther, Jurassic Park. Nick, what's your overall advice for a newcomer for a Seattle summer? What do you want? One thing that I should keep in mind if I'm new.
If you're new to this city, I think that this city is built in such a wonderful way that we have these urban villages throughout, where I think that if you really want to get to know the city, get to know your neighborhood first. Find that stretch in your neighborhood. There's one in almost every neighborhood in Seattle that has those restaurants and those cafes, and go there first and then make some friends, make some connections, even to the people who work there, become a regular. Ask them what they like to do in the city and explore it that way. I think that if you go from neighborhood to neighborhood and explore it in that way, you end up with a much more organic and holistic view of the city than when you just ask somebody who you don't know, like, hey, what should I check out? And they'll say, Just go to Seattle Center. There's tons of stuff there, which there is. There's a Marvel exhibit at MoPop right now, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. But you're going to get a lot of those stock answers. And those stock things in general are going to be there anytime. Take the time early on, if you're a newcomer, to get to know your neighborhood. Be local. Become a person in your community and then branch out from there. It's so amazing. I live in the Central District. I've been there for about 5 years, and I'm so glad that I did it that way because I feel like I'm part of that community now.
I like that. Become a neighborhood regular. Charlotte Spang is here, too, from the Seattle Aquarium. You run the Beach Naturalist Program. Charlotte, welcome.
I do. Thank you so much for inviting me today.
What would you say? What's your take on for a newcomer, Seattle summer? What to bear in mind?
Well, I really agree with that neighborhood focus. When I was thinking about this earlier, I thought, yes, in the summer, I love being in my neighborhood. Get to know your neighbors. The rest of the year is kind of rainy and gloomy. We don't even really see the people we live next to.
Right.
And then in the summer, everybody has a smile. Everyone's really friendly. Everybody comes out. So it's a great opportunity to get to know your neighbors.
Because they will ignore you in 6 months.
They will definitely ignore you in 6 months. That's famous Seattle freeze, right?
Fight the freeze.
Yes,
fight the freeze.
So in the summer, that's a great opportunity to get to know your neighbors. And
so as I say, you run the Beach Naturalist Program at Seattle Aquarium. What would I find at the beach in the summer I might not know about?
Yeah, so not only we can meet our human neighbors, but we can meet our animal neighbors by going out to the beaches in the summer. We have over 240 volunteers who are stationed at 12 different beaches on low tides. And I was just looking over what we saw at our last beach days, our good low tides in June, and we saw octopus at almost every beach, so live octopus.
You see octopus at low tide?
We do. I can't guarantee that you'll see them every time, but there's a good chance you'll see them. Also, all the amazing crabs that we enjoy in our area, as well as clams, all the little cool things that you never see. You'll learn about how amazing a barnacle is. Like, really, that's one of my favorite critters on the beach is the lowly barnacle.
What's so great about the barnacle? Does it cut you?
The barnacle is what?
Is it that it cuts you?
No.
What's great?
So it builds its own house. So it starts out its life as this tiny little thing floating in the water. And then it senses a good place where it's going to land. So it can sense, smell, lick, taste, whatever, a place where other barnacles live. And then it shoots out this glue. And then it permanently secures itself to that place. And it will be there forever.
Yeah.
So their glue is so strong, scientists are still trying to figure out what makes it so strong. Like, if we could figure it out, we could conquer lots of problems if we knew about barnacle glue.
Charlotte Spang, even more impressed with barnacles than with octopi.
Yes, I am. Yeah. They're amazing. And then they live their whole lives with their heads glued to the rock, and they eat with their feet, these things called cirri. They can open the door to their house when the time to eat is appropriate, and then they bring everything into their mouth with these frilly little feet. If you ever get a chance to go to the beach, you'll see some barnacles underwater. You can hear them if it's really quiet. You can hear them feeding. And if you look, you can see their little feathers. Yes.
That's
you'll hear this
terrifying
little like crackle, crackle, crackle sound. Huh. It's super cool. So yeah, we share our shores with these amazing animals, even things like barnacles, which we just step over and don't really know. But they're like super important for our local ecosystem.
Anna Sophia and Nick, the barnacle wasn't even on either of your lists.
I know, I feel some shame now.
You left it off.
I'm sorry.
Indeed.
From the Northwest Nerd Podcast, I'm so sorry that I left off the barnacle. It sounds amazing. I also didn't know that their head is what is glued to it and they eat with their feet because I'm used to walking upright. And what a human-centric way to look at the world.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Already expanding my mind. I got to go to the aquarium.
It's not about you,
Nick. You do have to come to the aquarium and then come meet us out at the beach, too. So we have, we'll show you lots of cool things. Cool.
Beyond aquarium, you do more than aquarium. What are some other ways people can get into the water within city limits?
As we were talking about our neighborhoods, I live in the North End. And so one of my favorite places to go is the locks. You're not necessarily in the water unless you're passing through the locks. But we have volunteer naturalist station there, too, talking about the salmon run. So you can see salmon. You can see boats. If you like engineering, you can think about how amazing this structure is that's been built and all the rerouting that happened in order to get ships to come through that area. There are bands that play in the park. We were there for our training recently for volunteers, and it was on a Wednesday, and it was a ukulele band, and it's just a meetup for ukulele players. Hmm. And how happy, I mean, nobody can listen to a ukulele and not feel super happy. So,
right. Yeah. Much like the banjo. And the barnacle is also on the list for me.
Yes.
Okay. What have we left off? What do you want to tell our listeners? Maybe some of them are new here. New or otherwise, what else do you want to say about summertime in the Seattle? Do you have a story to tell?
There's also a lot of great stuff just a road trip away, and even just after summer as well. Like coming up in September, there's both Rose City Comic Con and Renton City Comic Con, which is even closer to Seattle.
What's Rose City?
Rose City is down in Portland.
Oh, Rose. Yes, yeah, Rose. Portland.
Yeah, got Rose it. City Comic-Con down yeah. in Portland. And that's happening the first 2 weeks of September, I believe. But there's so many different conventions and stuff like that. If you're really into the nerdy stuff like me, I would say if you're new here, go check out the Northwest Nerd Alert group on Facebook because we post so many different events on there.
What is nerdy about you? What does the nerd part mean?
The nerdy part about me or about the podcast?
Well, both. I mean, both. What? Because nerd has shifted a lot. I'm yes. old, and like nerd was not a compliment when I was a kid. But now it's like you're a soccer nerd. You're everything, you know, kind of just nerd is like nerd equals love.
In particular, I'm a comic book movie, sci-fi, both TV movie and book nerd. I'm an NBA nerd as well.
An NBA nerd?
Yeah. I got way too excited about the salary cap machinations that were happening this week as free agency opened up. Just don't get me started. We'll need another hour for that one.
I feel like it means enthusiast at this point, right?
It means enthusiast.
It does, yeah.
That's true.
We've reclaimed it.
Yeah, what I'm a barnacle nerd.
You're a barnacle nerd. What are you a nerd about, Anna Sophia?
Oh, no. About, I don't know, being like in my neighborhood coffee shop. I feel like a coffee shop nerd.
Really?
That, like, I'm an enthusiast about going to local spots.
Is it about, you're a nerd about the actual coffee and like the provenance
no, like
and
the
terroir?
It's a, I wish. I'm not that cool.
Okay.
No, I'm more of like the atmosphere, the welcoming nature of coffee shops, because I think that's an important part of our neighborhood, like character and integrity.
I see.
Yeah, and I think the whole nerdy thing, right? So I said joke that I'm a barnacle nerd, and I think it's just this community of people who are excited about something, and we share an interest and are excited to learn more and meet others. And so I think it's about the adventure of learning together and expressing that joy together.
On Twitter, Melissa says, for live music, she goes to the U Village on Wednesday and Thursdays at the Olympic Sculpture Park and Sundays at the Locks for live music. Melissa has a whole plan.
Wow.
Yeah, that's
great.
Also at the Sculpture Park, there's a beautiful little beach there, which is the only place that I know of in downtown Seattle where you can actually dip your toes in the sound. So after you finish listening to music there, go on down to the Pocket Beach. Yeah. And sometimes we have our volunteers there, too. So
there's also the Chamber Orchestra. They're doing music outside all summer. They're in Columbia City, in downtown, and also at Volunteer Park throughout the week. Another cool place to do that.
And you're into the rooftop cocktail party, I understand.
Ideally, I would be.
Uh-huh.
I'm not that, again, not that cool.
I see.
But I think Frolic in downtown, I believe, and I think The Nest and a couple of other spots are doing movie screenings up there. So it could be a fun way to take a break from work after 9-to-5 grind,
yeah,
and kick back.
And once again, cocktails come into it for Anna Sophia.
Hey, that's
It's a summer thing.
It's a summer thing. Summer.
If you did want to take a pretty and kind of long drive out in Spokane in August, there's a KuroNikoCon going on, and it's a anime and manga focused convention out in Spokane, but it's very cosplay heavy, which is a costume play for people who aren't as deep into the nerddom as I am. Mm. Basically, people who are so enthusiastic about characters and stories that they want to dress up as closely as they can to be these characters. But what they do at KuroNikoCon is especially cool because they'll have a cosplay contest to see which the best costumes are in different categories, but also cosplay linksit battle and cosplay chess, which there's a video
life
on
size.
YouTube right now that I can tweet at you later, but it's human people on a chessboard, each of them dressed as a different cosplay character. So it might be somebody from Overwatch going against somebody else from Star Trek or something. And
can you mix and match them, or do you have to have an entire side full of like Harry Potter? You've got to be consistent.
That would be even more difficult to put together.
That would be hard to put together.
It's all mismatched.
Okay,
so you can have a bunch of different kind of characters, and then you have captains on each side who are directing them, and then they will, once two figures on the board collide, they play fight each other. So you might have a situation where one character literally brings a knife to a gunfight because they're just from different stories.
Right. Barnacle versus octopus, possibly on the chessboard. Who knows?
We have costumes for barnacles, too. It's the aquarium.
See, you thought I was kidding.
We've dressed up
That's
as barnacles.
Barnacle cosplay at the aquarium. And that was Charlotte Spang telling you about that. Anna Sophia Knauf is with the Evergrey, and Nick Jarin is from the Northwest Nerd Podcast. And they're giving you some ideas about how to have a great summer, whether you're brand new here, whether you're a long-timer. Thanks, everybody, for coming in. Happy official summer.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you. Same to you.
It's The Record on KUOW. And hey, I have breaking news for you. While we were here talking about summer fun, President Trump just said he has accepted the resignation of Environmental Protection Agency Chief Scott Pruitt. That's right. The EPA deputy administrator is going to act as the leader until there's someone new comes along. We've told you about Scott Pruitt's many, many troubles. We'll follow that story as it develops. Our show today produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Allison Bruzek, and Jason Pagano. Social media producer Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tune in tomorrow for the Week in Review.